Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Linda Bilmes, who is a professor of public policy, where she teaches budgeting and public finance at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She's recently been featured in the powerful documentary No End in Sight, soon to be released on DVD, and her research with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has shown that the actual cost of Bush's war in Iraq is much larger than he has stated. It's not several hundred billion, but over 2 trillion, or at least up to 2 trillion, which means it costs 720 million a day. And, of course, World War II cost 3 trillion. So I'll be looking into what the war costs and then what we get for the money we spend with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. He had a recent collaboration with Kanye West. Mr. Spray was the primary designer of 2 key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He's now appalled by the war in Iraq that Paul Wolfowitz, a person he's known for 40 years and who, as Deputy Secretary of Defense, helped initiate, Pierre Spray, it's an enormously unjust war and is not fought for the reasons put forth. Very simply, I don't think we should be going to war for oil companies. So I'll be talking to Pierre Spray about the procurement of weapons, given that we spend more than the rest of the world combined on defense. And then we'll talk with Dr. Joseph Silverstein, who is a distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's an expert on Myanmar, Burma, and the author of Burma, Military Rule and the Politics of Stagnation, and Burmese Politics, the Dilemma of National Unity. And we'll be looking at the brutal clash between those who hold moral authority and those who have the guns, as well as those who have an economic stake in this tortured country. Let me begin with Linda Bilmes, who's a professor of public policy, teaching budgeting and public finance at the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard University. She served as chief financial officer and as assistant secretary for management and budget and deputy assistant secretary of commerce at the United States Department of Commerce in the second Clinton administration. She was responsible for a budget of $9 billion and for financial management and for the administration of 45,000 employees. Much of her previous work was in Eastern Europe and Russia, assisting in the privatization process. Her current research topics include the cost of the Iraq War, federal workforce reform, and public pension liabilities. Her forthcoming book, The People Factor, is on civil service reform, and her recent work with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has shown that the actual cost of the war in Iraq is much larger than has been stated. As I mentioned, it could be up to $2 trillion, and we expend $720 million a day to prosecute this war. And Linda Bilmes, of course, was recently featured in the powerful documentary No End in Sight, soon to be released on DVD. And the $720 million a day figure, Linda Bilmes, I think the figures that the Bush administration have released, what is it, about $480 million a day? What, and then you make up for it with future liabilities.
Right. I mean, Congress has already spent about $600 billion in Iraq and Afghanistan, and with the current request, it will be brought up to $800 billion. In cash costs, but that's only the cost of essentially combat pay for soldiers and reservists and contractors. That's just the operating cost. That doesn't count the money, the sort of promissory notes that we will have to pay to take care of veterans, to provide medical care to veterans, and to replenish the military equipment that is being used up at 6 times the peacetime rate.
And that's how you ultimately come to the two trillion figure.
Right. I mean, the 2 trillion figure, if you break it down, includes the cash costs of operations, the kind of long-term costs that I was describing. In other words, the cost of taking care of veterans who've been wounded in the conflict, as well as economic costs for example, there are many costs that are borne by society, but not by the government. For example, somebody who is severely brain injured may require 24-hour a day care for the rest of their life, but not all of that is paid for by the government.
And of course, the $2 trillion figure should be contrasted with the $3 trillion that World War II cost. And of course, people have been watching, I imagine a lot of people have been watching the Ken Burns series on World War II. And we fought this war longer than we fought World War II, and it's cost two-thirds as much already.
Well, I think, you know, I should just say the $2 trillion figure was a figure that Joe Stiglitz and I calculated 2 years ago when we first started to look at this. I mean, that did include a number of long-term costs. But since then, the costs have escalated much more quickly than we had expected. Everything has gone up faster, and indeed the kind of burn rate in terms of the cash cost has gone up from about $8 billion a month then to about $14 billion a month now. So I expect that the cost will considerably exceed $2 trillion by the time this is over. And Joe Stiglitz and I have a book coming out in March that will detail the full range of costs.
And of course, there's just $190 billion just being added or asked for.
Right.
But this cost, though, as far as I know, most of this is in supplementals, right? So this has largely been off the books so far. So who's really doing any accounting here, apart from yourself?
Well, you know, one of the most troubling aspects about this war is the fact that there has been no transparency on the cost. And despite the fact that every government organization that looks at these things, you know, which is the Congressional Budget Office, the GAO, the Defense Department's own inspector generals and auditors have complained about the fact that, in the words of the auditor general, we really don't know where the money is being spent. The money has been rushed through in a series of so-called emergency supplementals, which means that the budget folks on from both parties who normally scrutinize budget numbers and try and make sense of what are we buying and how much does it cost have not had time to actually look at these budget requests. So you have obscene amounts of money, $55 billion requests, with three pages of justification, very cursory. At the same time, most domestic programs that ask for an increase of $2 or $3 million, tiny increases, have to provide hundreds of pages of detailed justifications.
And so this opens the door to waste and abuse and fraud.
It is inevitable. It's inevitable that if you don't have people who understand budgets and who understand how money should be spent, accounting and tracking the money, that there will be waste and fraud. And indeed, there have already been at least two dozen criminal contracting fraud cases which are being under investigation. Depending on who is counting, somewhere between $7 and $35 billion that has just gone missing. There are hundreds, literally, you know, hundreds of accounting discrepancies in terms of tracking the location of equipment and vehicles and financial transactions. And, of course, there are the sort of cost overruns at Halliburton and other contractors that we're so familiar with.
Well, Linda Bilmes, I mentioned earlier the $3 trillion figure of what World War II cost. And, of course, we won World War II. For all intents and purposes, lost the Iraq War, and many think we're in the process of losing the war in Afghanistan. So how can you get away with, as you mentioned, this lack of transparency in the budgeting itself and the spending? At the same time, you don't have any results. I mean, you're losing. I mean, I can't believe that there's not more outrage from the taxpayers who are allowing this wholesale bleeding of the Treasury.
Well, you know, I think that's a good point, Ian. I think it is deeply troubling. And if you look at what happened in the private sector after the Enron scandal, there was a wave of revulsion among the public and in Congress that this had been allowed to happen. And the Sarbanes-Oxley laws were passed, which require personal liability, personal accountability from the CEOs and board members of major corporations for their financial statements. Now, if you had can you imagine if you had a Sarbanes-Oxley type of a law at the Pentagon, you would have Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld essentially personally responsible for billions of dollars that are missing. And they would be currently certainly under investigation and for where the money has gone. And instead of that, we have a situation where everyone, including the auditors for the Pentagon, say that they just do not know.
Well, it's sort of mind-boggling that this is continuing, and it's worth noting in your study. And by the way, last week I spoke with Jamie Galbraith, who is with the kind of umbrella group, right?
Right, he's an economist for peace and security.
And did they commission this study?
No, but we presented our study initially at a panel that they sponsored at the American Economic Association.
And the money that's spent per day in the Iraq war could buy homes for almost 6,500 families or health care for 423,529 children. That's, of course, ironic given the president's threatened veto this week of the program for medical coverage for poor children, or could outfit 1.27 million homes with renewable electricity. So these are just some of the costs, $720 million a day, or if you like, $500,000 a minute.
Right. I mean, I think that there are a number of ways that you can think about the magnitude of this cost, but the first question is the counterfactual question, which is if this money, I mean, essentially we have spent $2 trillion to buy a war, and what could we have done with that amount of money if it had been invested in the U.S.? And even if we had not fixed a major social problem, just the multiplier effect in terms of investing that money at home would have significantly strengthened our economy. And instead, we have had a large amount of money that has ended up with a very, very low multiplier, meaning that the sort of impact of spending the money has been much less beneficial to us than if we had spent the money at home.
Well, let me ask you this then, since both you and the Nobel laureate, Joe Stiglitz, deal with macroeconomics. What has this done to our competitive position in the global economy?
Well, I think that the United States is a wealthy country, is still a rich country, so I don't want to overestimate the impact. But clearly, the expenditure has weakened our position, economically speaking, and it has weakened it relative to where we would have been. Now, on the political side, of course, the weakening is enormous. And when you look at opinion polls around the world, around the Middle East, indicating the fact that the United States is seen as a greater threat to world peace than countries like Libya, it is hard to quantify the amount of damage that this has done to our prestige and to our image around the world. But just to say, one more thing, it's very hard to get a grip on the amount of money that has been spent here, because millions and billions and trillions kind of sound the same. I tell my students that if you have a stack of $1,000 bills that equals $1 million, that comes to about 4 inches high. $1,000 bills that is a $1 billion comes to about 350 feet. And a $1 trillion is 65 miles. I mean, it's so much bigger than we can sort of imagine. So when we're talking about trillions of dollars, we're really talking about a quantity of money that could have been used to fix some of the most vexing problems in the United States. For example, that could have made the Social Security system solvent for the next 75 to 100 years. Or that could have made a significant impact on the Medicare problems or that could have provided universal health coverage for kids.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Linda Bilmes, the cost of replenishing the equipment, the military equipment that's being run through it at an alarming rate. So given that we spend more than the rest of the world combined on defense, and yet our deterrent, our ability to deter our enemies appears to be going down rather than up. But then factor that in, because if this is, you know, ripping into the Army and the Marines, then in terms of our militaries, we're spending a lot of money but getting the opposite results.
Well, I mean, and that's not only the case for equipment, but certainly if you look at the long-term sort of structural situation of the Defense Department, we have, in order to attract recruits, we have had to significantly increase the number of recruiters, to significantly increase combat pay, to significantly increase the amount of that we pay people to sign up, to reenlist, and so forth. And those are costs that are structurally going to continue to be high because the difficulty of attracting and retaining troops has gone up. And I think that many military experts and many generals have spoken out about the enormous toll and strain that this has put on our military. And as you know, I have written extensively about the issue of returning veterans, and we already have seen more than 250,000 returning Iraqi and Afghan veterans going to the Department of Veterans Affairs for seeking medical care, many of them facing long waiting lists to get in to see doctors, many of them also filing disability claims and facing waits of up to 2 years to get their claims settled. And this is an area where we really have not planned ahead, and where we will be facing, we're facing a significant challenge, both financial and a moral challenge.
And obviously social as well.
Yes.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Linda Bilmes.
Okay, thank you very much, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Linda Bilmes, who's a professor of public policy, teaching budgeting and public finance at the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard University. She served as the chief financial officer and assistant secretary for management and budget and the deputy assistant secretary of commerce at the United States Department of Commerce in the second Clinton administration. She, along with the Nobel economist Joe Stiglitz, have come up with a study that finds that we've spent up to $2 trillion on the Iraq war so far. That is $720 million a day, or if you like, $500,000 a minute. I'm now speaking with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Mr. Spray was the primary designer of the two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986, and he said because it became increasingly obvious that the atmosphere of the Pentagon was such that it would be impossible to build another honest aircraft. He is the owner of Maple Shaved Records and has enjoyed considerable success when one of his recordings was used by Kanye West in the mega hit Jesus Walks. He is now appalled by the war in Iraq that Paul Wolfowitz, a person he's known for 40 years and who, as Deputy Secretary of Defense, helped initiate. It, quoting, "It is an enormously unjust war, not fought for any of the reasons put forth. Very simply, I don't think we should be going to war for oil companies." Now, since I've quoted you here, Pierre Spray, let me begin with last week I spoke with Jamie Galbraith, an economist, who suggested that the idea that we're fighting, you know, the president said we're fighting, that we're addicted to oil, and I sort of said, well, does that mean we're fighting a drug war in Iraq? And he said, no, it's not quite that simple. It's not that we went into Iraq for oil. It's that what we're doing, and perhaps whether this is intentional or not, is keeping the Iraqi oil off the market, which therefore keeps the oil price up. So I'll give you an opportunity to redress whether or not you think we're fighting this war for oil.
I totally agree with Jamie Galbraith. This war, as well as the Gulf War I, were fought in order to deny us access to oil, not to give us access to oil. That is, to keep Iraqi oil in the ground so that this outrageously high price of crude oil, very artificially supported by a cartel, a long-standing cartel, can remain high.
And then,
in that sense, of course, the war was fought for the oil companies, but certainly not for the consumer getting access to oil.
Well, indeed, when you consider that in 1973, our Saudi friends turned off the tap, and we had an oil crisis, and I recall seeing people here in Los Angeles weeping because their license plates ended with an odd number, and they could only buy gas on an even day. And
right.
And you realize how pathetically addicted we are, and how the political elites have done nothing since 1973, when the writing was on the wall. I mean, it's
quite the opposite. They've made sure that the oil company control of those kind of supply crises has increased. I mean, that wasn't a real supply crisis then,
right.
And it wasn't really due to the Saudis. You know, the Saudis didn't invent that idea by themselves. They were put up to it.
Well, we could probably spend the rest of this
yeah.
interview talking about this subject.
Right.
But I wanted to talk to you about procurement, since we've just gotten through with Linda Bilmes, who's done a study saying how much this war costs. And I wanted to talk to you about what we get for all this money, this $2 trillion that apparently this war's cost us so far. And it's worth noting, of course, that World War II cost $3 trillion. And I know people have been watching the Ken Burns series. And of course, this war in Iraq has gone on longer than World War II. When you say, though, that you quit the Pentagon because we can't make an honest aircraft anymore, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it was never easy to make a really good airplane. That wasn't easy in World War II, and it wasn't easy in the 50s, and it wasn't easy in the 60s. For a wide variety of reasons, you know, part of it is that when you have huge bureaucracies, you know, designing, you know, highly technical affairs like a fighter aircraft, they're gonna make a mess of it, right? Because they all have much more important things motivating them than whether the airplane's going to work well on behalf of the pilots and work well on behalf of the defense of the country and whether it's going to cost a reasonable amount. So part of it is simply, you know, standard bureaucratic ineptness throughout the, you know, military history. Part of it is, a very important part of it, is the tremendous influence of the contractors. And that's what's been getting worse over time. I mean, not that there was ever a golden age, and that goes all the way back to World War II, when contractors didn't have undue influence on procurement and on the flow of money to them. It's just now it's so out of hand that there's no possibility that you could design an airplane that actually would be a good fighter, that would work well on behalf of the pilots, that would, you know, be effective in the next war, address defense needs that the country really needs, and not abuse the taxpayer horribly.
And
none of those things are possible anymore.
And I believe that you think that this F-22 Raptor is a turkey.
It's a classic example of what I'm talking about. You know, I mean, the initial specification, which by the way by now is totally ancient. You know, that the design of that airplane dates back to the mid '80s. I mean, imagine that, and we're just now bringing it into service, and I should say limping into service with it.
Well, tell
that,
me
that airplane started as a horrible bureaucratic mess. It never had a well-defined mission like, say, the A-10, which was supposed to support ground troops, or the F-16, which was simply supposed to be the best fighter in the world for shooting down other airplanes when we started it. The F-22's mission, truly, was to simply carry a laundry list of technologies, you know, stealth, frequency agile radar, a whole list of, you know, complex and expensive technologies. And the reason that was the mission was because the underlying mission was to send money to the contractors. The underlying mission of the airplane was to be expensive and to, you know, be a reason for bringing in a huge, huge multi-billion dollar budget to the contractors who are building the airplane. Now, when that's the mission of an airplane, obviously you're not going to get something very good out of it. And in fact, what's happened is it's gone from bad to worse. It was a bad idea when it started, and it's gotten worse in the execution. So now it's this hugely expensive turkey, well over a third of $1 billion. I mean, unprecedented. For
third of a trillion, you mean?
Hmm?
Third of a trillion.
No, a third of a billion per airplane.
Oh, a third of a billion per aircraft.
Per airplane. I mean, unheard of.
So three. You buy three of them for $1 billion.
Well, you can't quite.
Right.
Maybe two and a half for
two
a billion.
And a half. Well, you know, there's an old joke that a camel is a racehorse designed by a committee.
Exactly.
But idea that we're wasting all this money on this turkey, I think has consequences, does it not? Because you simply can't get any more blood out of the stone in terms of the treasury, although we're getting, you know, this war's costing $2 trillion. This war doesn't require F-22s and aircraft carriers and new destroyers and new submarines.
Quite the opposite. Those things are getting in the way of this war. You know, not that there's any good solution to this war anyhow, but just from a purely military point of view, the existence of all those weapons and the fact that a lot of the useless weapons are deployed to Iraq anyhow to simply, you know, justify the reason they were bought, they actually hurt the war. They hurt the war effort, and they get more of our people killed than need to be killed.
And what's the reason then that for this, the big ticket, the gold plating? Is it just because, as you pointed out, that if you can pile a lot of money into one contract, then that's the dream for the big defense contractors like Northrop, Lockheed, and
You have to remember that the fundamental incentives of the procurement process have almost nothing to do with war. War is simply the hook on which the procurement process is hung. The procurement process is about sending money to the contractors, and of course, so that the contractors can in turn help out their favorite congressmen and can in turn hire the generals who helped them when those generals retire. I mean, this is the famous military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke of so gutlessly as he was leaving.
What he originally said, the military-industrial congressional complex.
Right,
and
exactly.
And deference to the Congress, they took that.
Absolutely. And the Congress is an enormously integral part of this whole system.
But, so we are in an odd position here amongst the Western democracies in the United States. We have a form of right-wing welfare. How much do you think this kind of welfare to corporate welfare is responsible for the social cost we have here, where we don't really have the kind of social safety net that other democracies have?
Well, I mean, first of all, I totally disagree that this is right-wing welfare. This is highly bipartisan welfare for defense contractors.
I guess it's well, it's a form of peculiar form of socialism, you have to admit.
Oh, it's welfare for big corporations. There's no question. It's just the Democrats just as enthusiastically support it.
Well, they actually, I think they, in many regards, they invented it because it was Eisenhower who was railing against Symington and Johnson and Rayburn and all these Democrats who'd created this trough.
Exactly. So I think you want to be very careful to see that this process is above partisan politics, so to speak.
Right. Well, when we talked about the bias towards the big tickets, and that's why all this money's getting wasted on these useless weapons like aircraft carriers, submarines, destroyers, and the F-22, none of which are going to do us any good.
They don't work.
Right.
You know, and you can go into great detail on each one of them and the extent to which they don't work, and it varies some. For the most part, although we'd have to get down to specifics, they're completely irrelevant to whatever form of conflict we might face in the next quarter century or so.
And I guess in those terms, the revolution in the security landscape where national security and nation states fighting each other is receding into history, and that the new threats are subnational and transnational. Subnational, the disintegration of borders and ethnic strife. Transnational, meaning terrorism, drugs, crime, immigration, environmental destruction, etc. So this is, I think, a problem that everybody has, isn't it? The learning curve about how different the landscape is.
Yeah, and I mean that's been true throughout history. You know, the face of warfare is constantly changing, and the bureaucracy is constantly failing to recognize it. And the people who pay the price are the people who need the defense, and the people who have to fight the wars. They pay the price with their blood for the incompetence of the bureaucracy.
So our boys and girls over in Iraq, let's just deal with them for a moment, P.S. Bray. There was a piece on the PBS NewsHour featuring you and others about the body vests, the armor, the personal armor that the soldiers wear, suggesting that that dragon skin and one product was better than the one that the Pentagon's gone with, and that the testing was corrupt, and that the guy that headed up the Pentagon procurement of body armor ended up working for this particular company. Now, I've looked into that, and it turns out that it's actually more complicated than that, and perhaps not as that PBS may have got it wrong, that dragon skin weighs, I think, 80 pounds, whereas the other one weighs 30 pounds. I don't know how you could ever even walk around in that 120-degree heat in Iraq with that kind of body armor. So, and then on the other one, the F-16 rifle, they said that's 50-year-old technology. The bad guys have better guns than we have. So just walk us through those two.
Well, I mean, first of all, the body armor thing is in fact a very difficult and complex subject. All infantry subjects are difficult and complex, far harder to come to grips with and far harder to deal well with, to design good equipment for infantry than for airplanes, than for air combat, because there's so many more subtleties when you have people that intimately involved in combat. And the armor question is a classic among those. And, of course, infantry subjects get hind tit because they're not huge procurements in general. And so you get these particularly entrenched bureaucracies that do particular damage to the infantryman. Of course, he's the one who pays by far the most for every war we fight. You know, pilots are lost in vastly smaller quantities than infantrymen. And the armor question is a classic. It's not a huge procurement, so you have a small bureaucracy in control of it, a small and not very good bureaucracy. And they get their little pet contractors and stuff. And of course, the last thing in the world that they understand how to do is how to actually serve the infantrymen. And the armor question is a terrifically difficult question for a number of reasons. One, because the question of weight is so crucial to the effectiveness of an infantry, even more than just effectiveness, to his plain courage. If you put stuff on him that's too heavy, he simply loses his guts to fight. Brilliant work by S.L.A. Marshall, pioneering military historian on that. So the difference between 30 and 80 pounds is humongous for its effect on infantrymen. And the truth of the matter is we could have vastly better armor than either the standard armor or the dragon skin, and it could be much more attuned to allowing the infantryman to continue to do his job without being crushed by weight and fatigue.
There's not
a chance that bureaucracy will accomplish that, and not a chance that high-ranking generals in the Army will be particularly interested in that subject.
Well, you know, it's Duncan Hunter, the chair, or the used to be chair, now he's the ranking member on the Armed Services Committee, running for president as well. I think dragon skin is in his district, so that's why he's pushing that.
Yes, indeed.
So there you go. Tell me,
he's one of the champions of pork, by the way.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are other disgraceful things going on in his district that he's heavily backed.
Right. What about the
rifle is rifle. A much worse and much sadder story, a terribly sad story. The M16, which gets such bad press today, was the victim of a terrible, terrible bureaucratic sabotage during the Vietnam War. The origins of the M16 were one of the great, great American small arms designers, a guy named Gene Stoner, designed the M16 as a commercial venture called the AR-15. By dint of, you know, enormous effort and personal sacrifice, part of it by a very good friend of mine named Colonel Halleck, who sacrificed his career over the introduction of this tremendously effective new rifle. 90,000 of them were deployed in their commercial form to Vietnam and performed brilliantly for the troops that had them there. It was the most reliable and by far the most effective weapon in the theater. The Army bureaucracy that controls small arms, we used to call them the arsenal system, were horrified by the success of this weapon because it wasn't designed by them or by their pet contractors. It was done totally outside their system. And they went to battle stations to make sure that the Army would not adopt this highly superior, super important weapon, because nothing is more important as a weapon of war than the rifle. It's simply vastly more important than fighter airplanes, radars, submarines, all that. They all pale in comparison. And they deliberately sabotaged the weapon. They deliberately put it into production. They couldn't stop it from going into production because it was so successful that General Westmoreland asked for it, and they couldn't refuse him. They deliberately put it into production and sent it to combat with a powder that intentionally would make it fail and jam. And thousands of American infantrymen were killed with jammed rifles in their hands. It became such a huge scandal that the Congress actually did an honest investigation.
Did any heads roll? I mean, this is to talk about high crimes and misdemeanors and treason. I mean, this is treasonous.
It was, and the Congress said so in their report. The I-Corps report, opening page, says that the Army's conduct in the matter of the M16 bordered on criminal, they used that word, criminal malfeasance. It was one of the strongest things the Congress has ever done.
Yeah, but anybody go to jail? Anybody get punished?
No, but they were threatening, basically with the phrase, they were threatening the Army that jail might follow. Mm. And if the Army didn't fix the weapon pronto, the Army did fix it kind of in half-assed fashion and made it usable. But this was already late in the Vietnam War. In the meanwhile, the arsenal system had ginned up a huge lobby of their sympathizers in the NRA and in the general, you know, weapons enthusiast, rifle buff community against this weapon, calling it a squirrel gun and a simple .22 and claiming it was unlethal and all this stuff, all total slander and, by the way, all technically totally wrong. The weapon, in fact, was vastly more effective than any rifle we'd ever had. That clique still exists today, and they're still bad-mouthing the weapon. You know, you get all this stuff on the Internet that's so recognizably NRA crap.
But what are they offering in it? What are they pushing in an alternative?
Well, I mean, right now they're pushing in all directions. The bureaucracy itself wants to build some high-techy version of a rifle that's going to really be a mess.
Right, that's the one that's
got... They're ambitious to turn it into a multi-billion-dollar procurement, which rifles have never been.
Right.
So they're experimenting with all kinds of laser-controlled rifles and smart rounds and flechette rounds, all this stuff that they've been working on for years in an attempt to join the high-tech crowd.
Yeah.
Different manufacturers, of course, are jumping into the fray. There are actually a number of good 5.56 millimeter rifles that is using the same M16 round around the world. The M16 itself is in fact not a disaster at this point. It's not as good as the original AR-15 because the Army never completely undid several aspects of its sabotage. But it's a usable weapon. The main weapon about which this complaint, and properly so, is the carbine version, the shortened version. And that was another thing that the Army completely messed up. They took the
That's the one that they use in Iraq, though, isn't it?
They use it a lot, and they do need a carbine, and this one's incompetent. But that doesn't mean there's something wrong with the M16. It's just something wrong with the people who turned it into a carbine.
and are our boys and girls dying as a result of this new weapon? Is it jamming or?
Yes. It's having a lot of problems. It's not as it's not as huge a problem as it was in Vietnam, where literally thousands and thousands were killed by this army sabotage, by the arsenal system sabotage. It wasn't the whole army.
Pierre,
it's a disgrace that we can't get small arms that really work well.
Well, Pierre Spray, just in closing, obviously this is an endemic and historical problem going back to the Civil War where tainted meat was sold to the Union Army, etc.
Right.
Is it in the sort of DNA of this country that this kind of criminality can't be stopped? Or is there any, I mean, first of all, we talked with our first guest, how come we're spending $720 million a day on this war that we're losing? It's one thing, we won World War II, so that $3 trillion, you could say, was worth it. We're losing this one, and we're up to $2 trillion. So where's the outrage there? And then now, having talked to you about what we're spending this money on, I'm even more outraged.
Of course. And it's not endemic to the DNA of the country, but it's very much endemic to the DNA of the military bureaucracy, the procuring bureaucracy, its contractors, and the Congress that's a party to, to this outrageous corruption in weapons procurement. That has been existing. And by the way, it way predates the Civil War, let me tell you. you should see the corruption that was involved in the procurement of frigates before and after the War of 1812. This is a long-standing thing, and we're not the only country, by the way, that suffers from it. Mm-hmm. The English have an equally sorry history of corruption in naval procurement and other procurements.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that old adage of Samuel Johnson's that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel.
Yeah.
And it seems to apply here, but, when you get the drumbeat from the NRA and all these contractors. I saw the in the clip on the news hour, the people in the Congress posturing, how could you say that the United States Army is involved with corruption? It's the same stuff that goes on with how could you criticize General Petraeus? It's this phony patriotism that's so obnoxious.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, these small wars bring it out far worse than anything else. One of the reasons that World War II wasn't anywhere near as bad as Korea, Vietnam, and this war, is that World War II was a war in which the nation really was engaged, and it, not that the ultimate existence of the U.S. was really threatened, but it was a large war of great consequence to the U.S. The small wars allow far worse corruption to go on because they aren't of consequence to the U.S. They aren't, nothing in the U.S. is being threatened except, some pocketbooks.
Well, I'd love to talk to you some more. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd like to do come back again if we could, because I know you've done some work on these. Debunking these conspiracy theories about the 9/11 World Trade Center and stuff like that. So that's something we can talk about in the future.
I'd be extremely interested to help you in any such things. I'm an enthusiast of what
it's a rotten
doing.
Job, but somebody has to do it. I thank you for joining us, P.S. Bro.
And thank you for being so open-minded.
Thank you.
Great.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. He has got a recent collaboration with Kanye West. Mr. Spray was the primary designer of the two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. I'm now speaking with Dr. Joseph Silverstein, who is a distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University. He is an expert on Myanmar, Burma, and the author of Burma, Military Rule and the Politics of Stagnation, and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. And given Professor Silverstein, that we have this tragic standoff between those who hold moral authority, the monks, and those who have the guns, the army. Of course, you have to add to the mix that there are countries like China that have an economic stake in this tortured country. Is there anything we can do beyond hand-wringing?
I don't think there is, unless we want to physically get ourselves involved in it beyond where we are, and I don't see anyone speaking out along those lines.
And in terms of what's happening in this struggle between, which was provoked, I guess, by the demonstration on the part of the monks, and has been so brutally put down, it's not as if it hasn't happened before. It happened in 1988. I think far more people were killed then, but we don't know how many people are being killed. There's some evidence that the monasteries have been brutally attacked, and there was also a report of a monk floating down the river, a corpse of a monk floating down the river. So the extent to which they have been rounded up, killed, or put in concentration camps is yet to be determined. But can you just give us a sense of the lines being drawn here between moral authority and the thugs with the gun? What can we expect from this moral authority?
Right at this point, I think it's uncertain where it can go, because we don't know how much elbow room they have to maneuver. Yes, you're right. The reports are that there have been lockdowns in the monasteries, that the monks have been confined to them, and the few that were outside are being rounded up. But I think I would disagree with your original statement. This didn't begin with the monks. It began when the military seized power way back in 1962 and overthrew a liberal democratic federal government that was held by most observers to be the most advanced of Southeast Asian nations, and with its resources and good population, the most likely to develop quickly and be leaders in the area. That never happened, largely because of the military takeover, the destruction and suppression of the liberal constitution, and the rule by force rather than by law or even moral authority.
And, of course, we remember U Thant, the UN leader, who came out of that period of liberalism.
Yes, he was a man who rose alongside of then-Prime Minister U Nu, and he went to the UN and was the ambassador, and proved to be, in the midst of the Cold War, one of the few diplomats who could be acceptable on both sides. He stood up to both the West and the East, spoke his mind, spoke truth to what was being said, and I think did an outstanding job in that particular period.
So it's extraordinary to think that these generals have been able, having turned back the clock 45 years ago, they're still in power. This is, of course, and I believe the new incarnation of generals are even more brutal than the original ones, are they?
Well, they seem to, because they certainly have better and newer weapons, and they certainly have no hesitation to use them in the most direct fashions. Today we learn on repeated broadcasts that the one Japanese newsman inside was confronted by a soldier holding a weapon at the ready, and this brutal soldier shot him down. And we already have the Japanese report, because they sent in a special investigator, that he was shot and killed by several bullets and then left to die in the street.
So what? How do you explain how do we understand an army that goes to war against its own people? Obviously, there's been evidence of that, something of a tragic tradition in Latin America. But in this case, what motivates these young recruits to do what they do, given the pervasive nature of the Buddhist religion. Although I understand that the government have got these kind of thug-like mercenaries, the Lone Tien.
Lone Tien, yes.
Yeah. That, so first of all, in terms of the soldiers themselves, why do they...
You have to go back and look at the society and the origins of the military. The society, first of all, is a multiracial society. Although the majority of people are Burmans, there are 35% of the population who represent other ethnic groups with different religions, with different values. And for a long period of time, they have lived largely in self-contained areas. In fact, the original federal structure was to create states for the largest of the ethnic minorities, and it was supposed to be that they would be able to enjoy the right of self-rule in their state. This was never honored by the rulers, and it provoked civil war almost from independence. So we have to look at Burma as a country in civil war since 1948. It began with a communist uprising. It was followed by the Karen, one of the largest of the ethnic minorities, and shortly thereafter, other ethnic minorities went to war against the state. And this has been the history that we have to keep in mind. And the military sees itself as the only glue to hold the state together. They don't take into account the fact that the people have never been given what they were originally promised when they formed the government in 1948, and that it is this miscommunication, deliberate misrepresentation, and the attempt to rule by force. Because what we had was, for example, that there was supposed to be an army created out of all the people, recruits from all the different ethnic groups. But once the military seized power, they immediately began to retire or not recruit amongst the minority. And as a result, the army today is overwhelmingly a Burman army. And the Burman army has imposed not only its will, but its identity. The term that is now being widely used, Myanmar, in place of Burma, is an example. The British, when they came and conquered Burma in the 19th century, they didn't know very much Burmese, and the word Myanmar could easily be translated for them as Burma. And Burma became the name of the country and the collective name of all the people until independence. But the military, among its first actions, has been to change the name, arguing that this was an example of Western imperialism, and they had to root Western imperialism out. And so instead of finding a common name that everyone would accept and would not demean or elevate one group over the other, they imposed the Burmese old word for Burma, Myanmar, and that has been the word that they will accept. So even though the United States doesn't accept the term Myanmar, if they want to communicate formally with Burma, they must use the new name or the communication will be returned. So this is the situation we have to keep in mind to understand that there has been no national unity in Burma. These people have been at their own goals because the national goals are not any that the people have agreed upon. And so, as I said earlier, there have been civil wars going on continuously. And right as we speak, there's at least three important wars going on the eastern frontier with the Karen, the Shan, and the Mun very much involved in warfare against the state.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Silverstein, who's a distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University, the author of Burma, Military Rule and the Politics of Stagnation, and Burmese Politics, the Dilemma of National Unity. And into this mix, of course, you have the manifestation of the Buddhist monks who've demonstrated. They've been brutally suppressed. They were apparently marching with their begging bowls upturned, which apparently has some significance, which you'll explain, I hope. And of course, this kind of protest on the part of monks goes back to 1929, when a monk led a hunger strike against British occupation. They also, I understand, though, nevertheless bestow legitimacy on the rulers with the Sangha, which is the Buddhist hierarchy. Where do they stand in relationship to these thugs that are beating up their brethren?
Well, they're possibly brothers or cousins or fathers of members of the armed forces, because the Sangha, which is the name for the monkhood, is recruited out of the ordinary people, Burmans, and it is an act that young boys go through at the early part of their life. Every boy enters the monastery, and he lives there for sometimes a day, sometimes a month, sometimes a year, and it is there that he becomes a monk in training, if you will, and learns from the older monks the ways of the monastery and studies of faith. The monasteries played a key role in the pre-colonial period. They were the educators of the nation, and there was a kind of a symbiosis between the monastery and the people. The people were educated through the monasteries. They were able to make merit in order to advance in their succession of birth and death, and in exchange, the monks would and still make their daily rounds, going out in procession in the early morning, come to a household, they stop, and their bowl is upturned in their arms, and usually the woman of the household comes out and fills the bowl with rice or some other food.
And upturned bowl means, that's a sort of insult to the...
Absolutely. Right. The fact that the monks have turned their bowls over means that they are refusing to perform the normal duties of the monks toward the society, and this is a great insult to the military.
Well, we've run out of time here, Dr. Joseph Silverstein, but I guess the bottom line here is that the Chinese building an oil pipeline from China through to the Indian Ocean so that they can get oil out of the Gulf and not have to go through the Straits of Malacca mean that China's not going to budge on this one as long as they're operating in their economic self-interest.
They certainly are not going to budge on it, and they're much further along because there is a lot of new natural gas having been discovered on the southeast corner of Burma, and China has bought the rights to help develop it. There they are in competition with the Indians, who were once very close and supportive of the Burmese people, but they let their economic interests stand in the way, and now they compete with the Chinese to gain control of the natural resources such as natural gas, oil, timber, and so forth, order to increase their economic strength at the expense of the Burmese.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Joseph Silverstein, distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong and Lik Duan, the assistant producers, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available. Visit ianmasters.org.